I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Cohen and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Rabbi Shai Held, President, Dean, and Chair in Jewish Thought at Mechan Hadar, and author of the new book of essays on the weekly Torah portion, The Heart of Torah. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevinah on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinchinim, Bar El Kahar, and Leah Avuno, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Cohen and Too Jewish.
Shalom. People always wonder how it is that we Jews have survived for so long. What is the source of our people's vitality over the 3,800 years of our existence? What's the secret to the Jewish ability to remain intact as a people when no other religion or culture has endured from antiquity to today? How have we preserved our traditions, our texts, our ideals from the Bronze Age to the iPhone era? The answer is simple. And it's not pastrami on rye, nor is it chopped liver or even the mystical power concealed in matzo balls. The fact is that for the past 2,000 years, the principal source of life, learning, and community in Judaism has been the synagogue, whether it's called a temple, a congregation, a shul, or a kehillah. The synagogue is the only institution that guarantees Judaism will survive and thrive from one generation to the next. In times of joy or sadness, of peril or celebration, it is the synagogue that is the single indispensable institution of Jewish life. There are certainly many excellent Jewish organizations in the world that do good and important work. In my rabbinate, and often here on Too Jewish, we work closely with many of them, and we partner with all the local Jewish organizations in a variety of ways. They all try hard to affirm Jewish values and identity as they see them in useful and creative ways. But if, God forbid, all of these fine Jewish organizations disappeared and we only had synagogues left, Judaism would survive and ultimately succeed. On the other hand, if all of these Jewish organizations continued to function, but we were forced to endure even one generation without synagogues, Judaism in America, and really everywhere but Israel, would simply disappear. Without temples, there would be no more Judaism. With strong temples, Judaism thrives, grows, and evolves in healthy and vital ways. Within the walls and work of the temple, we celebrate life cycle events from Brit Milah to baby namings to B'nai Mitzvah to confirmation to weddings to anniversaries to funerals. Within the walls and work of the temple, children learn the joys of Jewish festivals, master Hebrew and prayer, understand Torah and God, celebrate Shabbat. Within the walls and work of the temple, we learn and practice visiting the sick, feeding the hungry, housing the homeless, redeeming the oppressed, fighting for justice and peace. Within the walls and work of the temple, we sharpen our minds, open our hearts, stretch our spirits, and sing our own Jewish songs of identity and purpose. My friends, it's important to regularly recall the centrality of the synagogue in Jewish life, because it is awfully easy to take the local temple for granted. After all, the synagogue will always be there when we need it, won't it? Whether or not we support it, or even enter it. Well, maybe. But in truth, in the year 2017, that's no longer a guarantee. For temples to continue to do the great work of Judaism and affirm Jewish vitality, we need to participate and support them. The other truth is that if you personally want to find meaning, purpose, community, connection, holiness, and value in your own life, the best way to start is by going to synagogue, by listening, talking, learning, praying, meeting, helping, and connecting. So, if you have a chance this coming week, go to Temple and experience just what an incredible institution a synagogue really is. It's a place to find yourself and your Jewish identity, now, in the future, always. To play us in this morning, here's a fun rendition of Shabbat melodies that you might hear in a temple this coming Friday night. It's from the Revivo Project from Israel.
Nekabela Shamimor bezachor betibure hadish mi'anu Elham meyuhad Adonai echad Ushmo echad leshemu tiferet ve'elitila Likrat Shabbat lechu venelcha Kihi mekor haberacha Verosh mikedem nesucha עכשיו התחילה לך דודי לקראת קלה פני שבת נקבלה לך דודי לקראת קלה פני שבת נקבלה
דודי ירד לו מקרמו ופרי גפנו הביא עמו פרחים כתף לו בדרכו ושיר לו בלבבו
שקעה במערב וכבר מהזרח כוכב מלאה שבת עד רצה איש איש באוהליו ובשבת הוא יזמר בחיל ברד שירי הלל לאלו הבעל טור בנה
That was the Revivo Project performing, singing Friday night prayers and songs for the eve of the Sabbath. Okay, in order to hear that kind of Shabbat music, you might have to go to a shul with Moroccan Jewish musicians, but that Mizrahi flair can be found in a lot of other temples too these days. Our guest this morning, Rabbi Shai Held, is the President, Dean, and Chair of Jewish Thought at Machon Hadar, one of the most dynamic and interesting Jewish organizations going today. He's the author of a new book of essays in two parts on the weekly Torah portions, The Heart of Torah. Meet Rabbi Shai Held and find out what's completely new about his approach when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through 8th grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish this morning our guest, Rabbi Shai Held. He is the president, dean, and chair in Jewish thought at Machon Hadar, which he helped co-found with two other young, dynamic Jewish thinkers, including another past guest of Two Jewish, Eli Kampfer. He has a new book out called The Heart of Torah, and he has been a Covenant Award winner for his work in connecting Jews to their heritage. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. So you could have had a career in academia, I think, pretty easily with your background. Why did you decide that it was more fun to do what you're doing?
Well, first and foremost, I love the fact that when you teach Torah, when you engage with people on this level, people bring their existential questions, their deepest searches for meaning, without being embarrassed about that or without being apologetic about it. I wanted to teach in a way that connected not only to people's minds, but also to their hearts and souls. And I feel very blessed that I've been able to pursue that path.
Your new book, The Heart of Torah, is, well, I wouldn't call it a Torah commentary exactly. It's a set of essays. Tell us what prompted you to write it and how you chose the direction you took.
Well, I wanted, on some level, my goal was to do something that I felt I had never really seen done before, which was to bring together in a set of essays on the Torah, on the one hand, the contributions and insights of modern academic scholarship, and on the other hand, the enormous contribution in learning of traditional Jewish commentary, both in the Talmud and in medieval Jewish commentary, and kind of to reach out to all of the voices that I could find that could shed light on a particular text and have them all talk to each other. Kind of an unapologetically eclectic project, the goal of which was to be intellectually sophisticated, deeply rooted in sources, and at the same time, spiritually and morally challenging and inspiring. It was really about creating a marriage, or at least a conversation, among kinds of resources and kinds of texts and thinkers that are not often or sometimes ever brought together.
You know, and it's funny they aren't, because, of course, the Talmud is a conversation across, I don't know, four or five, six centuries of scholarship. Isn't that something that a Mikro Gedolot, you know, would have sort of strives to do, at least on the page?
Yes, it does. I mean, I think what I was trying to do was to bring modern academic scholarship into that same conversation, to sort of have the Mikro Gedolot talk to a contemporary Bible scholar. So in the same paragraph, I'll have Abba Vanel, you know, a medieval Jewish commentator, talking to Walter Brueggemann, an influential contemporary Christian commentator. And it's sort of, it's really about expanding the voices at the table, essentially being committed to the project that Maimonides articulated of learning the truth from whoever says it. You know, also, I think many contemporary religious speakers find biblical scholarship dry or even arid, and in any case, inaccessible. And I want to try and translate some of the findings and the arguments of that literature into an idiom that Jews and, to some extent, Christians searching for meaning would find compelling.
It is compelling. We will talk much more with Rabbi Shai Held when we come back in just a few moments here on Two Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life, 322-7035.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOO Jewish Radio 18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. And now we welcome back a favorite, mystically recurring feature, our Zen Judaism Moment, Two Jewish's Haikus for Jews. Beyond Valium, peace is knowing one's child is an internist. And is one Nobel Prize so much to ask from a child after all I've done? That was our Zen Judaism segment, Two Classic Haikus for Jews. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We talked last week about a very interesting article that posits that Yiddish actually has its origins and the Ashkenazic people, or the whole Ashkenazic existence, comes from this central area of, I guess, northeastern Turkey, not so much central, northeastern Turkey.
Right.
Where they're all called, all the four villages are called Ashkenaz or something like that, and that that was sort of the origin point, and that Yiddish was a trading language before it was anything else, like a secret language of Jews, which was how it was in my house when my parents wanted to say something bad about the kids.
Right.
They spoke Yiddish. There, you mentioned the Khazaria, the country of the Khazars, which was a nation led by a Khan, a ruler, where he and the royal family converted to Judaism at some point in the kind of dark ages.
Like 9th century or something. They were Turkic peoples who started with a fairly small kingdom in the North Caucasus, where there were many small kingdoms. But they expanded. They were imperialists. They built an empire that includes much of what today is southern Russia, northern Caucasus, much of Ukraine, and Kazakhstan. So it was pretty long east to west, not so big north to south. And as you say, the royal family converted to Judaism, and it was known as a Jewish kingdom of the Khazars. And you mentioned off air somebody who posited that all Ashkenazic Jews are descended from them.
Right, right. Arthur Kessler, famous writer from the 40s.
Okay, so this article isn't far off from that, because this article posits that when those trade routes collapsed for a variety of reasons, they became unsafe due to Mongol invasions and invasions by repeated waves of steppe peoples, various groups of Turks, et cetera, et cetera. That Jews from what they believe is Ashkenaz moved first to the Khazar Empire, but then the Khazar Empire fell apart because of all these waves of invasions. And finally, the nail in the coffin was the Black Death, right, which hit in the 14th century.
Right, it was a combination. First, the Count of Kiev and the expansion of the Russian Empire, right, and then the Black Death, right?
So when Jews had to leave Khazaria for all of these reasons, they moved either north into more purely Slavic spaces or northwest into Central Europe, which was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the German Empire, the Prussian Empire. I mean, it was all German-speaking. And so Yiddish continued to be used both among and between these two groups of Jews, but they also developed differences in pronunciation and words and whatever. But it explains why, although most of the vocabulary of Yiddish is based on either German or Hebrew, there are a bunch of Slavic roots, like schlep. In Serbian, it's schlepovat. And you have barges that schlep things up and down rivers. That's a pure Slavic word. There are a lot of Yiddish words that are purely Slavic. But the structure of Yiddish is apparently largely Slavic and not Germanic. And that could be explained by the fact that it comes from 3 or 4 centuries in Khazaria and then came to Europe via Slavic-speaking countries.
Fascinating. I wonder where Kvetch is from. That also somehow sounds Slavic to me, although it just sounds, frankly, Jewish.
Right.
Tom, thanks. Fascinating stuff. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivi non-Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We talked the last couple of weeks about this remarkable program called Mechina, in which instead of going directly into the army, 18-year-olds in Israel when they graduate high school spend a year of preparation and learning, both physical, emotional, intellectual, sensitivity to other aspects of Israeli society, and it's been really successful. Part of that year, what now Americans are calling a gap year, in other words, instead of going right on to college, which is not exactly like going right on to the army, is it? In Israel, there's a something called a Shnat Sherut, a year of service. We had some experience of that here with our Shin Shinim, the Israeli teens who do such a wonderful job in our community. But tell us how else that Shnat Sherut, what else can Israeli kids do in that 18 to 19-year-old year?
So that's the bigger phenomena, that that's Shnat Shirut. That's like, you know, let's postpone the army in 1 year and do something for our community and definitely for ourselves by volunteering. And you can find these volunteers, Shnat Shirut, a year of service. You can find them in hospitals. And by the way, some of them is also to offer tachlif, an option for religious girls. So it's kind of start with, you know, if you're religious and you do want to contribute, so you do 2 years of service, like the same that
that a
female will go to 2 years.
Woman. Right.
So it started with it, and they mainly offered, you know, secretary services in hospitals or in other places, schools definitely. Some of them were assistant teachers. So now it's much more broader, and it allow also Muslims who like don't want to go to the army because they feel like they betrayed whatever, so they can do something else, but they feel Israeli, so they want to do like a service, so they can go to Shnat Shirut and do a service in Israel. They can do it in their village, they can do it in, again, in a hospital. Sometimes it's tied into their future career if they want to be a doctor or whatever, so they can, you know, they can experience like how is to live in this so you will see shinshinim, we call them shinshinim, just in here but also in Israel.
Of course.
They can work with youth at risk, hostels, programs, they will do everything, you know, that everything that you can think of that, you know, the country need, like a fresh, energized,
bright,
teens,
talented,
exactly, talented
cheap.
And bright.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, and they, in a way, to prepare them to the army, and every program, every Shnat Shirut will include in a way some preparation to the army, you know, if it's going to different screening process for elite unit, so they know that you are going and they will provide the help they need. But in general,
it's a great program. And it, you know, again, the notion of national service, which in America has become very diluted. You know, we used to have universal conscription. Everybody went in the army. All guys did anyway. Been a long time since that was true in America, 40 mm-hmm. years. And more. So it's fascinating to see Israel expanding it in a way that mm-hmm. it's not just going in the army, which is such an important institution in Israel, but serving the country and understanding that commitment to serving the country. It's very powerful. Thanks so much, Ashrat. We'll talk
Tadah, Rabbi.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Tov, good morning.
Good morning. So this is what is referred to in the baseball world as the dog days of summer.
Hot and long.
Hot, long. And, you know, school is a long time ago, and it seems like a long time from now, although it's not really that far away.
Yeah.
How do you keep people engaged? How do you get particularly kids to be focused on learning and continuing to grow?
Sure.
And making connections to their Jewish heritage?
Yeah. Well, you know, during the year, we have the school year. We've got that structure and of course, the cycle of the holidays and the events and things that happen in our lives, baby namings, brises, B'nai Mitzvah, weddings, birthdays, etc. But what do you do in the middle of summer when it's July 16th and it's 100 and something out there? There's lots of opportunity.
So I mean, I'll throw in one. You know, you can go to Temple Emmanuel for Chardonnay Shabbat, 5 o'clock, wine, yes. cheese, and fruit, 5:45 service.
You know, the synagogues are right on top of this. And no matter what synagogue you're part of, Emmanuel or others, they have summer shul.
We have and services summer every Friday and Saturday. Everybody's welcome.
And the awesome air conditioning works. Downtown. Yeah,
exactly.
So there are different, and it's neat because there's a variation, and the services tend to be a little more upbeat. They feel a little bit shorter. And
the sermons are shorter,
yeah,
for sure.
And it is, no pun intended, it's a sanctuary from the heat and the doldrums.
Right.
But also you get to see people. And that's something I was going to start with too, is call up your friends, get your buddies together and do some hanging out. Especially those friends that you know through religious school or that you know through day school or whatever, those friends you might have had at your bar or bat mitzvah that might have been last month or is coming up or was so many years ago. So connecting with people is a critical part of that. And a great place to do that, I'll say, is at the JCC. Mm-hmm. They've got that awesome pool and the splash park and great facility there. So there are opportunities all around. You got to dig a little deeper and work on them. But you know, there's also that funny little box we have in our homes called the computer. And there are so many different kinds of things to find. And when you have the downtime without all the pressure, you know, you can send your kid on a hunting expedition and, hey, let's dig up some videos about Israel, or let's find, the newest kind of mashup songs that are on the radio that have been redone with a Jewish holiday theme, maybe Rosh Hashanah, Hanukkah, Passover, let's take a look right now at a live broadcast of The Wall and see what's happening. So there's so many ways to virtually connect and to stay engaged that, you know, we don't even have enough time to talk about it this morning.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, the other thing is invite people over for Shabbat. You know, you
absolutely.
Can do a cool Shabbat either Friday night or Saturday and
love
just
that.
Make that a fun experience.
And then on the other end, you've got a nice opportunity to do Havdalah.
Havdalah, yeah.
Outside, you know, the sun's down and the
it's
heat kind of lifts
a little bit. Yeah.
Maybe you see some stars. Maybe you do it up on Mount Lemmon. So you might have to dig a little deeper and work a little harder, but you can absolutely make it happen.
Thanks, John. We'll talk next week.
Have a great week.
Stay cool. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sharon meets Miriam, who has just gone through her third divorce. "Oh, you poor girl," says Sharon. "You must be absolutely shattered. I feel so sorry for you." "Ah, don't worry about me," says Miriam. "I might not be the perfect wife, but I'm a very positive person. I still have great pride in all the things I know how to do very well." "Like what?" asks Sharon. "Well, for example," replies Miriam, "I know I'm a good housekeeper, and I'm very proud to say it." "Please don't take offense, Miriam," says Sharon, "but that doesn't sound that important to me." "Well, to me it's important," says Miriam, "because whenever I leave a man, I keep his house." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portions of Matot and Maaseh, the last sections of the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. Both portions teach an important message about the centrality of Jewish family values, but they do so in very different ways. The setting for these final parshiot in Numbers is the border of the Promised Land. The Israelites approach Canaan for a second time after their 40-year sojourn in the wilderness of Sinai. As the tribes gather to enter the land, two of them, Reuben and Gad, make a strange request of Moses. "We like the land we're traveling through now, here on the east bank of the Jordan." what is today the country of Jordan, by the way, long before the Arab peoples moved into the Middle East. The leaders of Reuben and Gad say, "Let us stay here and build sheepfolds for our flocks and towns for our children." And Moses agrees, but in very interesting language. First, he tells them, "Build towns for your children, and then build sheepfolds for your flocks." The message is clear. Family comes first. Our professions and income second. It's a human message and one that we need to relearn in every generation, sometimes every year, perhaps every week. Put family first. And then, in the very last section of Numbers, called Maaseh, an important and unusual institution is created, called the City of Refuge. In the days before police forces and criminal courts, justice in cases of manslaughter or murder was accomplished by the family of the victim. Vigilante action was the normal means to address the moral and social disruption created by a killing. If you killed someone, intentionally or accidentally, or even if the family of a person who was killed just thought you'd committed the killing, you would likely be killed by their kinsmen. Which meant that if you're involved in such a terrible situation, you had very little chance to stay alive, even if the killing was accidental, even if you were completely innocent. The wheels of justice might turn for you eventually, but if you were already dead in a revenge killing, that wouldn't help much. This kind of reprisal killing also could and did lead to cycles of revenge, the sort of blood feuds that Mark Twain captured in Huckleberry Finn describing the Hatfields and the McCoys millennia later. The kind of clan murdering that still takes place in the Palestinian Arab towns in the West Bank and Gaza. To preclude this sort of social disaster, in the portion of Maaseh, the Torah provides for six cities of refuge in and around the land of Israel. No person who enters these cities may be executed without a fair trial. Being present in the City of Refuge is a kind of protection, the guarantee of due process that's become central in modern law, but was mostly absent throughout human history. Yet the Torah established that principle some 3,000 years ago. Whether it did so to protect innocents accused of murder or simply to keep families from falling into cycles of killing and revenge, we don't know. But we do know the Torah teaches us in this way, too, that the most basic unit of society has to be nurtured, maintained, and protected. Its positive values strengthened always, even under the worst of situations. A great message still. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Shai Held, author of a new book of essays on the Torah, one of the most innovative thinkers and teachers about Judaism, will explore what matters most to today's younger Jews. Find out what that is when we come back in a moment, right here on Too Jewish.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help. We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from our guest, Rabbi Batsheva Appel.
Toxic wastewater surged through a dry riverbed in southern Israel, leaving a wake of ecological destruction more than 12 miles long. The flood began last Friday when the 60-meter-high wall of a reservoir at a phosphate factory partially collapsed, letting loose 100,000 cubic meters of highly acidic wastewater in the Ashalim riverbed. The toxic torrent snaked through the desert, singeing anything in its path, before collecting again hours later in a pool several kilometers from the Dead Sea, the lowest point on Earth. One section of the Ashalim riverbed is made up of narrow canyons popular for hiking, but no one was around when the wastewater first gushed through. Israel's Ministry of Environment has opened a criminal investigation into the plant's owner. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu welcomed his Indian counterpart Narendra Modi to Israel, calling his visit historic. Modi arrived in Israel, the first visit to Israel by an Indian head of government. The visit comes 25 years after the establishment of diplomatic ties between the two countries. Modi visited Israel in 2008 for the first time when he served as chief minister of the Indian state of Gujarat. "My visit celebrates the strengths of centuries-old links between our societies," Modi said during a welcoming ceremony at Ben-Gurion International Airport. He said he would work to build a strong and resilient partnership with Israel. Omri Kaspi, the first Israeli to play in the National Basketball Association, signed a one-year contract with the 2017 champion Golden State Warriors. Kaspi, 29, and the Warriors agreed to the contract. He is expected to provide some offense off the bench for a club that will be seeking its third title in four seasons. "I'm happy to have received this amazing opportunity," Kaspi said in a statement. "This is a childhood dream that has come true, to play for such a respected team alongside such great players. I hope to start training soon and begin the hard work." Kaspi, who has averaged 8.2 points and 4.1 rebounds per game over his eight-year NBA career with five teams, was a first-round draft pick in 2009 by the Sacramento Kings. The 6'9" forward was a member of the championship Maccabi Tel Aviv team in Israel before making himself available for the NBA draft. Karam Mashour, 25, a 6'4" small forward from an Arab Christian family in Nazareth, signed a two-year deal with an option for a third season with Maccabi Tel Aviv basketball team. He started playing basketball at the YMCA in his hometown when he was 13, and after playing at the college level for Morehead State in Kentucky and the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, and sadly being passed over by the NBA, Mashour joined B'nai Herzliya in Israel's Premier League. It was hard for Maccabi Tel Aviv not to notice him. He helped B'nai Herzliya destroy them in three separate season meetings last year, averaging at 4.5 points and 10.3 rebounds per game. Mashour also would have been central to B'nai Herzliya's win over Maccabi Tel Aviv in the quarterfinals if he hadn't been sidelined for a shoulder injury. But despite that shoulder injury, and despite the fact that the season wasn't even over yet, Maccabi Tel Aviv insisted on taking Mashour. This year's American delegation to the Maccabia is the largest ever, with over 1,100 participants, second only to the Israelis. But the team has only one archer. Rabbi Shira Rosenblum, who has taught archery at Camp Ramah in the Rockies, was previously the number two ranked archer in Massachusetts, and this year came in fourth in the New York State Championship. He is representing America alone. Rosenblum, who began competing in archery at Brandeis, is an ordained conservative rabbi. During her year in Israel while in rabbinical school, she happened upon the Jerusalem Archery Club, which graciously permitted her to use their facilities and equipment. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. This is Rabbi Batsheva Appel.
We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Shai Held, theologian, scholar, educator, is president, dean, and chair in Jewish thought at Machon Hadar, which he helped co-found. He also directs the Center for Jewish Leadership and Ideas there. His first book was Abraham Joshua Heschel, The Call of Transcendence. His new book is The Heart of Torah, a collection of essays on the Torah in two volumes, brand new, exciting, and interesting. Tell us a little bit about the founding of Machon Hadar, how that evolved.
Machon Hadar started essentially with two goals in mind. We wanted to build a center for Jewish ideas and a center for advanced Jewish learning that would pursue two projects. One was to create a stake in the ground for a certain vision of a traditional and egalitarian Jewish life. And for that, we run full-time programs, year-long and summer-long programs for young adults from around the world who study intensively in the yeshiva that we run. But we also, and this is the second piece, did not want to become another sectarian institution, to carve out a thin slice of the denominational spectrum and say, this is us. We wanted to be and are committed to being an institution that belongs to the entirety of the Jewish people. So the other major piece of what we do is continuing education opportunities that are attended by people from around the country and across the denominational spectrum. For example, a week-long program for rabbis, where rabbis from the Renewal Movement to Yeshiva University graduates and everything in between come. An executive seminar where people come from every corner of Jewish life. And we try more and more to use the internet to put ideas out into the world, to put lectures, audio files, podcasts into the world, to raise the bar on Jewish conversation for anyone who's invested in that project.
This is a very different generation for Jews. Maybe generation isn't even the right term. We talk about millennials and post-millennials. People don't join the synagogues that their parents joined. They don't necessarily even join any synagogues. What's different about reaching younger people today and giving them a connection to this incredible Jewish heritage?
I think one of the things that is true about this generation in general is that very little about what we assume is the Jewish landscape is taken for granted by them. So the establishment of Jewish institutions have an uphill climb in terms of convincing young Jewish adults, or convincing at least many young Jewish adults, that they still matter. The same is true about synagogues, where it is simply not self-explanatory to them anymore that they will join a synagogue. If they want to be part of a religious community and they don't find that a synagogue speaks to them, they may well go about starting their own. There's a much more kind of do-it-yourself spirit among this generation. In many ways, that's a good thing, and that they take responsibility for their own lives in those ways. And it's also a problematic thing, in that sometimes they, you know, leave community structures behind too quickly.
The desire to find something different or just not to do what everybody else does often leads people in interesting paths. Sometimes it's really positive, sometimes not so much. How do you try to help shape that as a Jewish leader?
It's interesting, because one of the things I often say to students is, be careful that in being a nonconformist, you're not like every other nonconformist, right? Because nonconformist is going to be a form of conformity, right? You know, I wear the same clothes that everyone else who doesn't wear what everyone else wears.
Right.
So I think what you're saying is actually spot on. I mean, one of the things that sometimes I find myself talking to students about is the integrity of one's own search, right? And what it means to really take seriously, A, the idea that I am searching for truth, I am searching for the best possible way to live, and B, I'm reminding myself day after day after day that it's not about me. Because one of the challenges, I think, of an individualized search is that spirituality can become a form of narcissism, right? It's, what do I find meaningful at this moment? What grips me? What makes me feel, you know, you can finish that sentence almost however you want. What makes me feel whatever I'm searching for? And to remind people that ultimately the spiritual life is about a form of self-transcendence, a form of learning to care about others, a form of centering my life around something greater than myself. So I'm all in favor of people pursuing an individual path as long as they don't get pulled into a sense that this is all about serving me. Religion is not about serving me. Religion is about learning that my life is about serving things greater than myself. But I actually find that message is sadly so rarely articulated to young adults that they gravitate to it very powerfully. You know, I think you find in this generation, for example, a much greater hunger than you would have expected to talk about issues of social justice and equality and fairness. And part of that really is about a hunger to be connected to something greater than one's own self.
It's funny because people are so focused on their own social media presence. People spend more time kind of presenting themselves to the world electronically than I think they ever have in human history. And yet there's an emptiness to that requires something greater that people still need to find.
Right. Well, it's interesting. This is something that I wrote about in my first book about Abraham Joshua Heschel. This notion that Heschel comes close to saying this. I'm not sure he ever quite says it, but I think it's really implicit in what he's arguing, which is that in the modern world, we pursue meaning by asserting ourselves. And the irony is that the more we do that, the further away from meaning we end up. Because we actually find meaning in centering ourselves on something other than ourselves. And so the modern forms of the search for meaning can actually make us feel more empty than when we started out. Which is why, you know, we always push students to ask, you know, what do I serve in this world? Whom do I serve? What do I serve? What is the center of my life? What besides my own ego? And there's all kinds of ways that we try to fill those holes in our society that are really empty. I mean, consumerism is the obvious example in many ways, the notion that having things will somehow make me feel whole. But of course, that's sort of ridiculous. You know, as Ecclesiastes already points out, people who have a lot of things then lose sleep worrying that they might lose them. Right? There's no way in which the pursuit of objects or whatever it might be, or fame or glory. Now, you talk about social media. One of the things that's interesting is, how do we have a culture that values genuine humility and modesty when we're all supposed to be branding ourselves? Even the way we talk about things. I'm not a brand, I'm a human being. And that's an act of counterculture in some profound way, to resist branding yourself as just be a person.
There are some who think that Judaism's greatest appeal in the marketplace of ideas today is not a religious one, but an ethical one. How would you respond to that?
I think that there is truth to that, and yet that it is complicated and even at some level self-defeating. So, on the one hand, it is clear that ethical passion, care for the weak and the vulnerable, insistence on justice, always seeking to do what's right, that those commitments are at the very heart of Judaism's vision for the world. At the same time, those commitments alone can be universal. And if we have a Judaism that only talks about those things, that Judaism will effectively liquidate itself. Because if Judaism is only about morality, then at a certain point you cut out the middleman and just embrace the morality. But again, I want to emphasize this point. The point is not that you can have a Judaism without morality. Morality is the very heart of the Jewish project. But you also need you need practices and commitments and a language that is in some way particular. So in other words, marking time Jewishly with Shabbat, marking food Jewishly, different Jews will do that differently around the laws of Kashrut, but you need particular practices that also culminate in and lead to this ethical commitment. You know, there was a modern Orthodox thinker named Michael Wishegrad who passed away recently, and in a rather caustic line, Wishegrad writes that ethics is the Judaism of the assimilated. And that's a really harsh comment, and yet you understand what he's saying, I think. The problem is, or the complexity lies in the fact that ethics is also at the heart of the Judaism of Isaiah, Jeremiah, and the rabbis of the Talmud. The question is, it has to be ethics plus. It can't be ethics only.
I remember hearing somebody say people compare being Jewish to being a good person, which is mistaking a 3,800-year-old tradition with the Boy Scouts of America. Are we kind of doing that?
Yes, and I want to actually begin, if I could, with just what you said about Judaism being about being a good person. I actually find personally that the language of being a good person feels sort of trite and empty to me, because I think Judaism's ethical commitments are far more radical and demanding than that. Judaism asks me to learn to be fully present with people who are vulnerable or going through moments of deep suffering in their life. That's what the sages refer to as walking in God's ways. That requires much more than being a good person, which I feel like in America is often a cliche. You know, I'm not an axe murderer, I'm a good person. Judaism is asking something much more profound than that. Can we be creatures, beings, who manifest compassion in the way we imagine God manifests compassion? And that is much more demanding than being a good person. Now, that said, I think it is true. The danger of reducing Judaism to a series of platitudes or cliches is real in parts of the Jewish world. And I think one of the things I often advocate for, and one of the reasons why I try to bring as many people as I can into our Beit Midrash, our study center, our study hall, is to really have people engage with Jewish language. I've often said to rabbis, you know, if I could take the word Tikkun Olam away from you, I would. Because at the end of the day, it's not that Judaism doesn't believe in that. It's that I would invite us all to speak the language that Judaism speaks. To talk about visiting the sick as Bikur Cholim, to talk about comforting mourners as Nichum Avelim, Let's not kind of reduce Judaism to a generic doing good, but let's engage deeply with speaking the language of Torah. That is our heritage. It is in part a language for talking about what really matters, and that requires becoming articulate. You know, no one imagines that I should be able to speak French on 5 minutes a month, right? The same thing is true. I can't speak Torah on 15 minutes of hearing a rabbi speak every few weeks. It's too hard. It's a language I have to invest in if I want it to truly be mine.
We are told in the middle of the Torah, on which your new book is based, Kadoshim Tihiyu, you should be holy, Ki Kadoshim Yenolechem, because I, the Lord, am your God, am holy. What does it mean to be holy in 2017 as a Jew?
That, I think, is a really, really profound question, which I struggle with a lot. I mean, I think one thing about holiness, you know, the literal meaning of holiness seems to be, or at least of the word Kadosh, to be other than, to be transcendent in some way. And one of the things I find myself thinking about a lot is the ways in which people often find themselves using their cultural tradition to sanctify whatever the static quo is. And that part of what it means to take Judaism and Torah seriously is to actually question that which is assumed as given in one society. To be countercultural in some way, to be other. Now, to go back to what we said before about conformism, by countercultural, I don't mean countercultural for its own sake. You can be countercultural and be a political right-winger, you can be countercultural and be a political left-winger, culturally right, culturally left. But the point is to sort of ask, what can Judaism offer here that is different from the conventional ways of living? What does Judaism have to say about living in a consumerist, materialist culture? What does Judaism have to say in a culture in which people blame the poor for being poor? I mean, whatever it might be, right? So I think holiness is in part about being other, and also about the aspiration to connect to something that is beyond me and beyond even my people, right? To connect to something that simply forces me to reach beyond my usual ways of thinking and my usual ways of prioritizing myself. I'm always going to care about me and my family because evolutionary biology has programmed me to do just that. But will I care about the neighbor who I don't know? Will I reach out to God in a moment of prayer even when I'm not even sure what I mean by God? Will I allow a text to hit me in the heart and not just in the head? That kind of openness, I think, is at least key to what holiness is or what holiness can be. Holiness, I would also just add, is always aspirational, it seems to me, right? One is never permitted to say, right, we are holy, but rather we are commanded to strive to become holy. There's a very big difference between those two things.
And holiness is a process of becoming. You're never completely holy. Can't be.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I often tell students a very quick story about one of the great Hasidic masters, Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kutz, which I totally adore, which is that a student asks him, Master, who is a good Jew? And he says, who is a good Jew? Anyone who wants to be a good Jew. So the student is sort of perplexed and says, but Rebbe, Master, who wouldn't want to be a good Jew? And the Kutzker says, who wouldn't want to be a good Jew? Someone who thinks he's a good Jew already. Now, that story to me is so powerful. The notion that aspirationality, yearning, the desire to become something that I am not yet, the commitment to become something that I am not yet, is at the very heart of the spiritual life in general and of Judaism's vision of a Torah-based life in particular.
I want to thank Rabbi Shai Held for a great visit here on Two Jewish. We'll have to do it again. His new book is called The Heart of Torah, Essays on the Weekly Torah Portion in two volumes, available on Amazon. And where can people go to find out more about you?
You can go to the Machon Hadar website, www.hadar.org. And to find out more about the book, one can also go to the JPS website, www.jps.org.
Shai, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Edie Berg, creator of the Strong Women's Club, a Jewish group that focuses on a new identity for Jewish women. Don't miss it. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from Yishai Ribo, a text from Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, the great love poem of the Bible, chanted by tradition on Friday nights as well. I pledge you, daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my love, what will you tell him? That I am sick with love. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
השבעתי אתכם, השבעתי אתכם בנות ירושלים, אם תמצאו את דודי, מה תגידו לו? השבעתי אתכם, השבעתי אתכם בנות ירושלים, אם תמצאו את דודי, מה תגידו לו? שכל התו אני, שכל
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.